Deutschlandfunk Sportgespräch.
Sportgespräch with Maximilian Rieger. Hello and welcome. Olympic Games in China, a country that has locked up 1 million Uyghurs. Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries buying the way into professional football, golf and other sports. Sexual, physical and emotional abuse of athletes from the USA to Japan. Just some examples of a global sports industry that some call immoral. But in this Sportgespräch, we are looking if there is a way for sport organizations and athletes to cure it. The question we are trying to answer is there a cure for sport? And I have to admit, this is not my question. This is the motto of this year's Play the Game conference. Play the Game is an initiative of the Danish Institute for Sport Studies. And the conference brings together people from all over the world, from the sports industry. And we use this opportunity today. Sitting with me in Odense is Jules Boykoff. He is a professor for government and politics at the Pacific University in Oregon, USA. He was also a professional football player and has since then developed a critical view on the world of sports, especially the Olympic movement, which he wrote several books on. Hello, Mr. Boykoff.
Hello, good to be with you.
Also with me here is Nicole Dryden. She's a former top swimmer, competed for Canada in the Olympics 92 and 96. Then she studied law and became a human rights lawyer who is now helping athletes to get the right. Good to have you here, Mrs. Yes. Dryden.
Lovely to meet you.
And to my right is sitting Miguel Maduro. He's completing this small round here. He's a dean of the Católica Global School of Law in Lisbon. Before that, he was a minister in Portugal, advocate general at the Court of Justice of the EU. And in 2016, he was chair of the FIFA Governance Committee, but only held this office for 10 months, I think, before he was removed. Maybe because he took his job a little bit too serious in the eyes of the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino. Hello, Mr. Maduro.
Hello, and nice to be with you and with the other two also.
Mr. Boykoff, on Tuesday, at this conference, Francesco Ricci Bitti, the president of the Association of International Sports Federations that compete in the Summer Olympics, said that he doesn't believe sport is sick and therefore it doesn't need a cure. Is he right?
He's absolutely wrong. If you take a look at the Olympic Games, there are numerous problems that are ingrained in the Olympics. It doesn't matter where they happen, you often see costs going through the roof. You often see greenwashing, talking a big green game, but not following through. You often see the militarization of public space, and you often see the displacement of everyday working people from the city and their forced eviction from where they live. This happens in various degrees in different towns. I've lived in numerous Olympic cities and seen it with my own two eyes. Perhaps if you're sitting in the luxury boxes, you don't see those dynamics firsthand, but I can guarantee that they exist.
Mrs. Dryden, you were an athlete. I just mentioned it before. Did you realize back then in what kind of system you were competing, or did it took a while to let that sink in?
Yeah, no. And some of it was purposeful, obscuring myself from it. Andrew Jennings' books on the Olympic movement corruption did come out at the same time as I competed, so 92 and 96. I mean, I was 17 in 1992. I was very sheltered. I was being abused by my coach, physically, emotionally, financially. So I didn't really have any perspective outside of my goals, which was just to win an Olympic gold medal. By 96, I was in university by that point. I was having other problems, like I had injury. So you start to get a bit more perspective as you age, but still I was only 21. But I had heard about Andrew's books by 96, but I purposefully did not read them until I retired. And then it was a very quick transition that I made from, you know, being naive and believing in that whole Olympic spirit and the sort of myth that surrounds it when you're competing in it and what they're telling you, to one that was a critical thinker about what is actually happening.
Why didn't you want to read the investigations about the Olympic movement by Andrew Jennings, one of the foremost critics of the Olympic movement, and earliest critics maybe?
Because I knew it was going to change what I was feeling and what I was thinking. I mean, I don't really know exactly what it was 25 years ago, but I do remember just sort of this feeling of like a little bit of dread that my whole world was going to come crashing down around me. And it was already so hard to be doing what I was doing, right? Trying to stay motivated through injury. I barely made the 96 Olympic team. I just dragged myself onto it. So I think I was sort of worried that it would impact my ability to focus on what I still wanted, which I still always, I mean, even at my worst, I was still thinking I was going to win an Olympic gold medal. It was very delusional. But I think I just wasn't ready for it emotionally or mentally. Like there was no space. And I think I didn't have any original thoughts. I remember when I transferred universities and people around me were doing like a thesis for undergraduate, I remember like, how do you have an original idea in your head? I think what had happened is when you're an athlete, you are trained to just not ask questions, to not think for yourself. And so I always look at my peers, like someone who's the same age as me, and I always think they're like 5 years more advanced than me in their thinking and what they've done and accomplished, because I just was completely sheltered and not allowed to think my own thoughts. I have sort of made good on that now, and I have a lot of opinions, but there was a period of time where that just was not allowed.
Ms. Madur, if we stay true to the metaphor, what are the symptoms of the sport being sick, and maybe what are the underlying causes?
Well, the symptoms are many and out there for anyone that just opens their eyes to see. Corruption, match fixing, tax evasion, money laundering, and sports has been named by the European Commission as one of the activities most prone to money laundering. Human rights abuse, you name it, it's a parade of horrors. What we need to understand is the reason for that, and that we actually, those cases that are revealed, it's just scratching the surface, because a lot of them, because of the fact that it's actually not a regulated activity to a large extent, it's very hard to uncover. Moreover, it's transnational. So no real national authority has concrete power and scrutiny over this activity. It makes it very easy. It makes it a natural area for illicit and criminal activities because of that transnational nature, because of that opacity, and the link between that and its culture of governance. That is a culture of governance with high concentration of power, no appropriate mechanisms of checks and balances, separation and separation of powers, very little accountability and transparency. So the connection between that culture of governance and the enormous financial volumes that are in place and that are linked to the economic activity, that sport is also here, make it an activity very prone to criminal action. Not to say that even when there is no criminal activity, there is systemic conflicts of interest.
Well, that brings me to your departure from FIFA. In 2017, when you are at the FIFA, you blocked Vitaly Mutko from Russia to become a member of the FIFA Council, because Mr. Mutko was at the same time the Minister for Sports in Russia, and the FIFA statutes prohibited such a double role to prevent any kind of government interference. And remind us shortly what happened then when you blocked him.
Well, it was not the only conflict we had. In 10 months, I had many conflicts. I was aware when I took office that we were going to, me and some of the other colleagues that unfortunately left with me too, we were aware that we were going to intervene in a culture that was foreign to the forms of accountability that we were supposed to try to develop. But the crisis of 2015 had happened, there had been a reform of the status, there had been the creation of this new governance body, and we were given assurances that we were supposed to take our job seriously. Apparently, we took it too seriously, and that was one of the ultimate cases of tension, where the president was, it is publicly known, was certainly not happy with the fact that we excluded Mr. Mutko from the FIFA Council, and particularly less than a year before the World Cup. But for us, it was clear. It was the rules. And that's the purpose. If the rules are there, they have to be applied equally to everybody. And it's not because it's the Vice Prime Minister of Russia or a prince of one of the Emirates that the rules are not to be applicable. That's what we did there and in other areas. But that's the difficulty. I've realized that while in function. Sometimes there were many other people that we excluded. And when it was actually, when these people were not people of power or of influence in the world of sports, it was not problematic. Every time that we touched someone that was more powerful outside of football or within football, then problems started to emerge, then pressures were being placed upon us. And it led me to understand the extent to which the culture of these organizations is foreign to the idea of the rule of law. And I think that that's perhaps the most important problem in sports organization, is one also of lack of genuine democratic mechanisms coupled with the absence of the rule of law.
So, Mr. Barkov, how do we change this culture?
Well, first, before we jump into that, which is a really important question, listening to Mr. Maduro speak really reminds me of the Olympics as well, because they have a charter and there are wonderful ideas in the Olympic charter. And for people like human rights lawyers like Nikki Dryden and others, basically you're just saying live up to your charter. That is a very low bar. And yet the International Olympic Committee can barely tiptoe over that if you look at what happened with the Beijing Olympics recently, with the incredible human rights violations there that are ghastly and that do not chime with the Olympic Charter in any way. So where do we go from here is the big question of our time. Well, first of all, start abiding by your own rules. That seems very simple at the outset, but that's definitely not enough. We need to have independent bodies who are overseeing both FIFA and the International Olympic Committee, and not just overseeing them, but that have leverage to actually impose sanctions or penalties when they do not live up to their own charters or rules. That seems like a bare minimum place to start. I could say a lot more about what needs to be done in specific scenarios and situations, but I would also say that as a general thing, infusing democracy whenever possible in both the selection of places that host these big mega events, whether it's through the bid process or the actual composition of the IOC and FIFA. When we look at FIFA and the IOC, we see a massive democracy deficit. And so everywhere you see a democracy deficit, let's bring transparency, accountability, and democracy.
So I actually have a question for Miguel, because what happened with me this week is I actually decided I was going to, I've been totally independent my whole career, and I made it purposely so that I could be a critic. I had a different job outside of sports, and I did that so that I could be the voice that of reason, I hoped. But I decided when World Swimming decided that they were going to create reforms. They came up with a big reform package at the end of last year, and there was a reform committee nomination process that went on. And I thought, this is it. If there's ever going to be a chance to reform world swimming or world aquatics, that now is the time. And I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. So I put my name forward for the reform committee. I did not get on the reform committee. I didn't even get nominated by the president. But when I looked at the people who did make it on, lack of independence, underqualified. I mean, I hit every single mark, and I don't usually brag like this. I'm not trying to do that. What I'm trying to say is I'm an Olympic swimmer, World Cup champion, a journalist that was, covered world championships. I've been to developing countries and volunteer coached. I care about swimming so deeply and spreading swimming throughout the world. But clearly they Googled me and knew that, I was going to be a fly in the ointment or something like that. But so my question for you, Miguel, is when you left, what happened? What's happened to that council? I mean, did they just fill it with people, which is what FINA has done?
Well, I don't like to talk about those that succeeded me, but I mean, certainly if you look at their profile, you don't see the profile similar in terms of independence from, I loved sport, football, but I didn't have any connection. I had never been part of the organizations of the governing world of football. And increasingly, they go back to that. Because it's what it was being said before. The problems to a large extent is not the rules. It's the independent enforcement of the rules. And I think there's a lot of things, there are additional things that we can do, there's additional rules that we could certainly adopt. I think we know what the cure is. What happens is that the patient doesn't want the cure. And basically it would only happen from the outside. That was the lesson
So who should be the doctor in this scenario?
Yeah, I think that there's two ways that we can try to do it. One that I think it it's fundamental, is really to have an outside independent agency monitoring at least compliance with fundamental principles of governance. I mean, I think we need to, we can continue to recognize to sports organizations, sports federations, some power of regulation in this area, but two things need to happen. Their regulatory powers need to be clearly separated from their powers as events organizers. Otherwise, there's a conflict of interest, clearly. We see that an UEFA that both organizes the UEFA Champions League and is the regulator of the activity, and then therefore acts so that City and PSG, that are so important for the economic value of the competition, are actually not sanctioned. For example, so that's one thing. But the other one is that this independent agency should supervise whether they comply with principles of good governance. They comply with genuine democratic elections. They don't discriminate against women. Was another fight that we had when I was at FIFA. Discrimination against women, not only as athletes, but in terms of sports officials, is widespread. Completely widespread. So that's something we do. The question is, who can do that? I think it's very hard to mobilize the international effort to do it. My suggestion has been that the EU should take the lead, because the EU has the critical mass and the capacity to impose that to UEFA and FIFA, and individual member states don't do. If Germany will try to do it, the next day, FIFA will exclude Germany and German clubs from its competitions. But they cannot do that to the 27 member states of the European Union. So the European Union has the clout and the capacity to act that. And then the second thing is really try to democratize, open up the, because this is a political cartel. They operate as a political cartel. So if you expand representation by including fans, by including more women, maybe that's something of unsettled that political cartel. It may have some effects too.
So let's stay for a second at this democratic movement in sports. So how do you create such a movement in international sporting organizations?
That is a really difficult question. I think a lot of people are asking it right now. How do you actually crack through the facade of these organizations? I think it's a huge task for one organization to take on. I like the idea of the EU when it comes to football. The Olympics are a little bit different. So I think for me, what might be a little bit more practical is to slice up the different elements of the Olympics, from human rights to more environmental issues to financial issues, and come up with different groups that oversee and maybe even have the power to, well, definitely have the power to sanction when they don't live up to the standards that they've laid out for themselves. And when I say they, I mean the members of the International Olympic Committee. So, for example, with human rights, you could have the organization like Sports and Rights Alliance, that's like got a bunch of different organizations together that could focus on the human rights part. You could get a coalition of green groups that oversee the claims around sustainability. And then you get people who are, again, independent, who look over the financial matters. And there are a lot of people that really care about sport in this world who are come from those three different areas. They could do the oversight of these organizations if they had the power and the funding as well.
And the mandate. So who's going to give the mandate for this kind of group? Would it be the IOC, or would it be the governments, the UN? I mean, we talk about the IOC, so there is a connection to the UN. Should it be the UN who mandates these kind of groups?
I think it could come theoretically from either place. I do not anticipate it coming from the International Olympic Committee under its current president, Thomas Bach. I think actually since he was elected, he's moved the organization in the other direction. It's become much more authoritarian under his reign. So I think it would have to either come from athletes or other people who are involved, stakeholders as some people like to call them, from the corporate sector, some of these big worldwide partners, for example, or from, I think the best source would be from athletes. And we're seeing as we look around the globe right now, more athlete groups coming together to organize for their own interests and the wider interests in society. Because having the Olympics like this doesn't help athletes either. I mean, we're sitting right next to an Olympian here who can say a lot more about that.
Yeah, I just wanted to turn to you, Mrs. Dryden, because you were an athlete and you still have a lot of connections with athletes. So do you agree that there is a kind of athletes movement in the last years to really be the drive for change?
I think the biggest, the thing that will hold us back is resources, right? So, and that's actually what will be the biggest thing that we wanted to negotiate for, right? So part of the problem is that there are some amazing athlete groups around the world. Athletes, Germany is one of them, right? They're the sort of gold standard in terms of what can happen when a government provides some independent funding so that you can hire a staff person to get the job done. And they've done it with a shoestring budget, but it's been, you know, what they have accomplished with such a small amount of money from the German government is extraordinary. Athletes can, you know, had more money and the Canadian government started to pull it back. So I think the biggest issue for that kind of a movement to really take hold is going to be funding and independent funding. So not, and in the U.S. it's a little different because the athletes are funded by the USOPC, but they're actually very dynamic and things have really changed in the U.S. in terms of some of that, where the USOPC, the U.S. Olympic Committee, has, because they had their wrists slapped by the U.S. Congress, they have sort of opened up a bigger space for athletes to start being more activist. So I think, you know, like, athletes can be part of that balance. I don't think we're going to take control unless we have a little bit more resources to be able to do the work, because all of us are doing it for free and we're continually exploited. You know, athletes who sit on athlete commissions are typically unpaid, and everyone else sitting around is paid. And that's sort of what happens on a board when you're sort of the interest group. You know, you can be in a boardroom where everyone there is a paid employee or coming from their company and being paid, and the athlete's the only one being unpaid. So it's a lot of work to be an athlete activist or to do this work. So I think it's really important and will be key in addition to these other ideas.
One thought that came to mind yesterday, we are talking about quite a Western perspective when we're talking about bringing democracy to the international sports federations, when actually the power seems to be shifting from the Western democracies to like countries like China. So did Western democracies miss the chance to create a democratic order in the world of sports, and now it might be too late?
I think partially yes. If you look at it, one of the reasons, since I followed it a little bit at that time, of the reforms or the attempts at reforms that took place in FIFA were driven by reputational risks and the impact that will have on sponsors. So the crisis of 2015, the uncover of a series of corruption scandals by the Department of Justice of the United States led a lot of sponsors to threaten to withdraw its sponsorship of FIFA, and that was an incentive to reform. But the reality is that since then, their sponsorship deals are made with companies from regimes that are much less sensitive to that. So to a large extent, that opportunity was missed. And I think we need, I actually believe that without public intervention, we're not going to succeed. But I think that at the same time, we do need a coalition of willing parties that needs to involve athletes, some of them because of the visibility and the capacity they have to connect with fans and the public, but on the other hand, needs an ecosystem that would also support and protect athletes. We have heard recently that several team captains in Qatar, England and others are planning to have protest during the next World Cup. What will happen, for example, if FIFA will decide that they were not going to authorize that they do anything on the field and they will then be threatened with sanction and all those kind of things? Is there an ecosystem protecting the athletes in those instances? At the moment, there isn't. So we cannot put too much of a burden on athletes too. We need to create an infrastructure with others to support and take advantage of this movement in athletes in favor of more integrity in sport.
I think one of the key things for me is having that government oversight and intervention. And it's happened in the U.S. recently. And I don't know if you want to talk about that, Jules. But from the human rights community, what we're talking about is making sure that the Olympic movement adopts the UN guiding principles on business and human rights. And what that will do is it creates a role and a responsibility for each of the entities that are involved in the Olympic movement. You know, governments have a role to play. The state is responsible for the human rights of the people in within its state, right? So the state responsibility is very important. And so far, because of sports autonomy, states have just said, oh, you guys can take care of this. And that has to end, right? So states have a clear Absolutely. Responsibility to protect human rights. The second pillar of the UNGPs is that business also has a responsibility to respect human rights. And that's where international sporting organizations, they have to start respecting human rights. And then the third pillar is that both entities, both states and sporting orgs, have to remedy human rights when they're violated. And so I think if we adopt that framework, and the IOC looks like they potentially might, FIFA has already done that, it's arguable whether or not they're continuing to implement it properly. I think that they started out strong and things have gone downhill. And then corporate sponsors also have that role to play, right? So if we adopt that kind of a framework, also that's going to create very specific rules for the state to come in and provide that oversight that I think we really need.
I don't want to take time out of Jules, but just quickly, because I was involved, it was one of the things, one of the legacies of my governance committee was the proposal for the FIFA human rights policy. But just to let you know, in words, everything is there.
Yeah.
All the rights things is there. The commitment for organizing entities with human rights. But the big difficulties we had was, first, even draft, we have the competence to propose it, not to adopt it, but to propose it. But even that, the administration of FIFA didn't want us to give us. They wanted them to draft and we will rubber stamp it. Mm-hmm. What we refused at the time, so it was one of the other conflicts, and we played an active role in drafting it. And one of the things that was a cause of contention, and I think ultimately is leading to its failure, is because we insisted that whatever was to be agreed, for example, with the organizing states of the World Cup or other events, they needed to set up independent bodies to monitor their own compliance, and that the independence of these bodies needed then to be confirmed by the governance committee of FIFA. In the meanwhile, they adopted a much more ambiguous rule, and I think that that's the problem. All the rule, all the rights are there, all the incentives, the policy is there, but without independent enforcement, it doesn't serve much.
In terms of the Olympics, they seem to have gotten through a little bit of an authoritarian bottleneck getting past Beijing. When you look ahead, the hosts of the Olympics come from democratic countries, but they got the Olympics through utterly undemocratic means. There was not a single referendum in any one of the countries that is hosting these Olympics. And if we look this fall, when the FIFA World Cup happens in Qatar, this is a really important crucible. I'll be watching for potential athlete activism on the field, and I think that could really help raise awareness. I'll also be looking in the stands, because if a fan waves a rainbow flag, we've been told by the head of security in Qatar, they could have that banner taken away from them. Let me be very clear. Qatar is not a friendly place for LGBTQ people, again, clashing with some of the principles that FIFA claims to embrace. And I think it's important as we move toward the FIFA World Cup and future Olympic Games to remember that actual everyday people are being hurt by the Olympics. We can have a discussion up here in the clouds at times, but everyday working people who do not have power are getting hurt by these mega events, and I'll be really interested to see how all that plays out and hoping for the very best in Qatar.
This was the Deutschlandfunk Sportgespräch with Jules Boykoff, Nicola Dryden, and Miguel Maduro. Thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
And you can listen to this podcast in the Deutschlandfunk Audiothek or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.